I was also not unhappy when our honeymoon was over and we returned to New York, to what was now our apartment on Horatio Street. It was time to play wife. I spent my days cleaning the small apartment, walking around the neighborhood, which was new to me, watching television and burning the spaghetti sauce. I didn't look for a job, nor did I socialize much with my friends. My mother came down to the apartment soon after I moved in to help me fix it up. But the dark, tweedy gray bedspread I picked out on 14th Street only made the apartment gloomier. She had tried to convince me to buy a hot pink bedspread, but I was trying to be practical and reasoned that the dark gray bedspread would last much longer and wouldn't show the dirt. That dull bedspread seemed like a perfect symbol of the marriage. Bob was a decent man, but it became clearer every day that we had nothing in common. I wanted to shake my despondency, and I tried. I shopped, more or less cooked dinner, asked him about his day at work, spent time with his family, and watched television with him at night. Bob left the apartment very early and didn't like to go out once he returned home. We both knew the marriage was in trouble and decided things might be improved if we moved uptown, nearer my parents and friends. We applied a temporary Band-Aid by renting a small but cheerier apartment at 81st Street and Madison Avenue. I decorated it and had a small dinner party or two, but I was still depressed. It would be years before the book and then the film, Diary of a Mad Housewife, elicited such recognition from housewives like me. But in the 50s, women thought their unhappiness was their fault and their fault alone. So I did what so many other women did. I went to a psychiatrist. He was a young man with a placid face and, in true Freudian fashion, rarely asked me a question and rarely made a comment while I prattled on about my failures as a wife. What I needed then was some advice on how to either live in this marriage or how to get out of it. He was no help at all. One possible solution, Bob and I agreed, was for me to go back to work. I was pleased to have his support. At that time, very few reasonably well-off married women worked outside the home. It was seen by some as a failure on the husband's part to make enough money. But Bob liked the idea that I'd be able to buy my own clothes and be more financially self-sufficient. And so it was, in 1955, that I got another job in television, this time at CBS, as a writer on the year-old The Morning Show. Early morning television had become a phenomenon with the debut of The Today Show on NBC 3 years before, and CBS was trying to play catch-up. At the outset, few had thought anyone would want to watch television between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m., but the creator of The Today Show, NBC Vice President Sylvester Pat Weaver, Sigourney's father, had proved them wrong. In spades. Within 18 months of its debut, Weaver's Folly, as skeptics had called it, became one of the most profitable programs on the air, and, of course, remains so to this day. There we were at CBS trying to challenge the highly popular host of today, Dave Garraway, and his even more popular sidekick, a chimpanzee named J. Fred Muggs. You know the old showbiz adage about never following an animal act? Well, we weren't following J. Fred Muggs, we were trying to beat him. It was a near impossible task. That chimp got more fan mail than Dave Garraway and even made a highly publicized world tour. This is not to say The Morning Show did not have its share of talent, even if they were Homo sapiens. A young Walter Cronkite and Charles Collingwood were the first co-hosts, with future Olympics broadcaster and wide world of sports legend Jim McKay doing the sports reports. By the time I arrived, Collingwood had been replaced by the actor Dick Van Dyke, who would go on to win 3 Emmys for his own long-running TV series with Mary Tyler Moore. The program then, as with the morning shows now, was a mix of news and entertainment. The boundary lines were already somewhat blurred. But in 1955, Dick was up against it at CBS. We all were. My job was to write and produce segments, mostly fashion shows using live models, which would help attract women viewers. There was no thought of my appearing on television. The only on-camera job for a woman then was as a weather girl. Speaking of weather, we used our reports primarily to boost viewership of the morning show. One gimmick followed another. First, we tried cartoons. Then, for a short time, the National Weather Report featured a young woman supposedly underwater in a glass tank, drawing circles on a map with a grease pencil to show the area being forecast. Then we tried an archery champion shooting arrows into a straw map. But no matter what we did, nobody watched the show. Looking back on those segments, perhaps it was understandable. A new production team was brought in with extraordinary talent. Fred Freed, who would later move to NBC and hire me for the Today Show, his associate producer, Robert Shad Northshield, who would also move to the Today Show, and the show's talented director, Av Weston, who would stay at CBS for 20 years before moving to ABC to become executive producer of, guess what, 2020. I had no way of knowing then that I had joined a fraternity of colleagues and friends with whom I would work for the next 30 years. All I knew was that the show was fighting for its life. Replacing Dick Van Dyke with Will Rogers Jr. and renaming the show Good Morning did not help. While Jr. had the easy smile and familiar twangy voice of his famed cowboy humorist columnist entertainer father, he didn't have his father's common touch, or any touch at all. Behind his back, we added a clause to Will Rogers Sr.'s famous quote that he'd never met a man he didn't like, that is, until he met his son. Will Jr. didn't have his father's humor either, despite the efforts of his young writer, a fellow named Andy Rooney. Even Andy couldn't instill much spontaneity into Will, but every bit of wit or wisdom he uttered came out of Andy's typewriter. For all the show's floundering, there were memorable moments, at least two of which involved me. I made my on-camera debut on Good Morning in a bathing suit. When one of the models for a bathing suit segment called at 5:30 in the morning to say she wasn't coming, Av Weston drafted me to take her place. "Go out there," he told me. "Put on the suit and talk about what you're wearing." So I did, praying I'd remember to hold in my stomach. To this day, I have the photograph of my first and last television appearance on Good Morning, and I don't look half bad, though nobody ever called me from Sports Illustrated for their bathing suit issue. The second memorable moment came from a tragedy. The collision on July 25, 1956, of the Italian luxury liner Andrea Doria and the Swedish ship Stockholm in a dense fog bank off the Nantucket Light. 51 people were killed, but many others survived, thanks to the ships that answered the distress calls, including the Île-de-France. 1,000 passengers from the sinking Andrea Doria were brought to New York during the rescue, and Av Weston ordered me to go down to the pier in the middle of the night to see if I could persuade some of the survivors to be on the show. This was my first hard news story and an invaluable experience in dealing with chaos. Many of the passengers were in shock, others hysterical. "What a horrible experience you've been through," I said to one after another. "You must be feeling terrible. But could you come into our studio tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. to tell us about it?" A surprising number, at least to me, said yes, and I pre-interviewed them so I could help plan the broadcast. The next morning, we went on the air with what proved to be an exclusive report on the collision. As horrible as the accident was, I had a sense of genuine satisfaction that we beat the Today Show to the story. It is always a difficult call when you are interviewing people caught in a tragedy. We all cringe when we see reporters shoving a microphone under a victim's nose and asking, "Did you lose anyone? How do you feel?" But sometimes, as with the case of the Andrea Doria, the questions must be asked so that the viewer can appreciate the extent of the misery. There are times when you want to put your arms around a distraught person, but you must restrain yourself. It isn't considered professional. Tact sensitivity, and common sense are all important, maybe the right word is judgment. But there are the times when your own emotion does take over. Not long ago, I was doing a story on transgender children. I was talking on camera with a 10-year-old girl born biologically a boy. As she was describing her deep sadness, she burst into tears. Instinctively, I took her in my arms to comfort her. When the program was actually aired, my producers felt that I was not behaving as a reporter and might be criticized. We cut that section out. The Andrea Doria experience was the first of many such situations I would face with people in genuine distress. And even though we celebrated the scoop, it was short-lived. Not long afterward, Good Morning folded. So did the subsequent writing project CBS assigned me to. It was a good concept, a series titled The Day That... We made two pilots, The Day That FDR Died and The Day That a Plane Crashed into the Empire State Building. The accident, a chilling precursor to the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center 56 years later, took place in July 1945, when a B-25 bomber lost in a dense fog flew into the 79th floor of the then-tallest building in the world, killing 14 people. But neither documentary ever went on the air, and the project died, leaving me without a job. It was later written that I went on welfare after I was let go, but that's not true. I did, however, go on unemployment for the first and only time in my life and collected the benefits I was entitled to while I looked for another job. I was also looking for a place to stay. My parents were living in Florida. Bob Katz and I had decided that our 3-year marriage had died a natural death, and I wanted to move out of the apartment. Bob could afford the rent better than I could, so I moved in with a kind friend from my school days at Fieldston, Marilyn Landsberger. I went down to Alabama and got a divorce in one day. I felt empty and defeated. Oddly enough, I also felt as if the marriage had never taken place. I didn't miss anything about my relationship with Bob. As I look back now, I can barely remember it. I never saw Bob again, except for one strange experience more than 25 years later. I was on my way to a dinner party in New York, and my escort and I were entering the building just as a vaguely familiar-looking man was exiting. He said hello, I said hello, and he left. "My God," I said to my escort, "that was my first husband." What I do remember vividly is that at the same time I was getting a divorce, another, far more devastating divorce was taking place in the family. This one, the business partnership between my father and E.M. Lowe. I knew the blood had been bad between them for years. Lowe continued to challenge every penny my father spent on costumes, on scenery, on talent, until my father couldn't stand it anymore. So he walked away from the gold mine he had founded and sold his share in the Latin Quarter to the partner he had long detested. My mother, when he told her, frantically tried to talk him out of it, but my father was adamant. She was beside herself with worry, as was I. The Latin Quarter had been the family's life support system for more than 20 years, and suddenly it was gone. "What's going to happen?" I asked my father, barely masking my own long-standing fear that I would end up supporting the family. But he reassured me. "Don't worry," he said. "I'm opening another nightclub that will be even more successful." That was my father's dream, to have nightclubs all his own with no business partner to rein him in. Even bigger, more lavish nightclubs than the Latin Quarter. First one in Miami, then another in New York. He'd call his new clubs the Café du Paris. As for the money it would take to open the clubs, well, that was no cause for concern. My father had sold his share of the Latin Quarter to E.M. Lowe for $500,000. He could borrow whatever else he needed from friends, from his family, no problem. The Café du Paris opened in Miami in the fall of 1957. It was struggling, but my father began making plans for the new club in New York. "The Café du Paris will be everything you can imagine," he announced to the press. We'll take the audience on a tour of Paris, the Moulin Rouge, Can-Can Girls, stars from France, Italy, London, ice skaters, and best of all, a mermaid swimming in a huge, supposedly champagne-filled crystal goblet. He rented the former Arcadia Ballroom on Broadway and 53rd Street, a huge space with seating for 1,200. He spent a fortune turning it into the largest nightclub in New York, with six stages all done up as he described the color scheme in shocking pink and golden white. My mother and Jackie moved up from Florida to a suite of rooms in a medium-priced hotel in New York, the Navarro on Central Park South. Every dollar was going into the new Café de Paris. If my father had any worries about the Miami Club, he didn't show them. He should have. Miami was having one of the worst winters ever. Freezing cold, lots of rain, resulting in far fewer snowbirds. Not only was the season a disaster, so was the economy. The country, still reeling from a recession in the early 50s, was entering another. The result was that the Miami Café de Paris was forced to close at the end of its first season. But neither the gloomy news from down south nor the downturn in the national economy bothered my optimistic father. He'd been there before. "Recession," he scoffed. "I've never had any trouble with that before. Back in Boston in 32, people were selling apples on the street. The week Roosevelt closed the banks was the biggest week I ever had at the old Cascade Roof." To my father, the recession was not a problem, but a plus. "When things are tough, people are likely to go out at night," he said. "They need a first-class escape, and I'm going to give it to them." Missing from his thinking was the realization that television was taking over New York nights. The performers he presented to the public for a price could be seen on television for free. The era of the great nightclubs was ending. He also didn't anticipate the vitriol E.M. Lowe was leveling at him for opening up rival nightclubs so close to both Latin quarters. Lowe went to court and won a temporary injunction prohibiting my father from using his own highly recognizable name, Lou Walters, on the marquee for the Café de Paris. Then came trouble with the unions, which many suspected Lowe had a hand in. Electricians, carpenters, painters, sound and light men began not to show up on schedule. Next, the suppliers, linens, food, liquor, staged their own slowdown. Even the club's liquor license was held up until the very afternoon that Café de Paris was due to open. But open it did, on May 22, 1958. My mother, Jackie, and I were at my father's table, as ever, when the extravaganza got going. The headliner was Betty Hutton, the exuberant blonde singer-actress who had soared to fame in the films Annie Get Your Gun and The Greatest Show on Earth. "Welcome to Lou Walters' rent party," Betty quipped to the packed house on opening night, a reference to the exorbitant rent my father was paying, supposedly the highest in New York. Betty remained a terrific draw and filled the club for the duration of her week-long contract. But even at that, the impressive $70,000 the Café de Paris took in was still $10,000 less than my father needed to meet expenses. And it went downhill from there. First, Betty turned down a 2-week extension of her contract, an extension my father had been counting on. Second, my father's frantic search for a new headliner to replace her ended with a complete loser. The controversial rock and roll singer Jerry Lee Lewis, best known for tearing up pianos and marrying his 13-year-old cousin. The cafe was practically empty on Lewis's opening night. Lewis himself didn't show up for his second night. And the goblet containing the swimming mermaid cracked and shattered, drenching some of the patrons and sending the mermaid to the hospital. My father was by now desperate. He had the nightclub's high rent to pay and a huge payroll to meet. He tried to borrow more money from his family in New Jersey, but they turned him down. I remember my father's brother finally telling him, "Look, Lou, we'll loan you money for yourself, but we're not going to give you any more money for your nightclub." The staff at the Café de Paris was more sympathetic. The maitre d' lent him money, so did the maitre d's wife, and the waiters and the busboys and the cigarette girls, and so did I. I had a new job by then in public relations, and I emptied my savings account and gave my father all I had, $3,000. It wasn't nearly enough. It gets worse. In June 1958, my father tried to kill himself. It happened several weeks after I had moved in with Marilyn and her parents, two of the sweetest people I've ever met. Marilyn and I were having breakfast one morning when my mother telephoned from the Hotel Navarro. "I can't wake your father up," she said, her usual matter-of-fact voice sounding close to panic. "He just won't wake up." I knew that the Café de Paris was in serious trouble, but the idea that my father would try to take his own life was not something I had ever imagined. Or had I? Was this the nightmare I had always dreaded? Everything over, everything gone? I had no time to think. I grabbed a taxi and raced to the hotel to find my father in bed, ashen and unresponsive. I tried to shake him. Nothing happened. I screamed, "Daddy, Daddy!" No response. Somehow, despite my own panic, I called an ambulance. Paramedics arrived almost at once and took my father out of the hotel on a stretcher. I knew my sister shouldn't come to the hospital, it would traumatize her, but she certainly couldn't stay alone at the hotel. So my mother stayed with Jackie and I went with my father in the ambulance. "Please, dear God," I kept repeating to myself, "don't let him die." I knew, as we sped to the hospital, that our lives would change drastically, whether my father lived or died. But for the first time, I had the most overwhelming feelings of love and compassion for him. I kept stroking his face and saying, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." All my resentment was gone. My poor, miserable father, so in debt. His beloved new nightclub a failure. His heart so heavy that he didn't want to live. Yet he had never discussed his grief with my mother, and I had been too involved with my own problems to explore his. The ambulance took my father to Mount Sinai Hospital, where the doctors and nurses saved his life. He had taken a heavy overdose of sleeping pills, the kind he had been taking in far lesser amounts almost every night for years. They pumped his stomach and did whatever else they needed to do to bring him back from the brink. Eventually, he was wheeled into a private room and put into a bed. His room was on the first floor of the hospital. I learned that this was where the hospital put people who had attempted suicide. I guess they were afraid the patient might try to jump out the window. But when my father was conscious, he just lay in the bed, weak, pale, and mostly silent. By this time, my sister understood what had happened, and both she and my mother were there with me. My father was out of danger and slept most of the time. We never left his side. We hovered around him, but he didn't say a word to us about his suicide attempt. Not then, not ever. Did he do it to spare himself the humiliation of his failure? Was it because he was so deeply in debt and hoped the insurance policy he always talked about would support my mother and Jackie? If this was his thinking, was it possible that he didn't know there would be no money from insurance? My father, it turned out, had borrowed heavily on the policy. There was nothing left for the family. Whatever his reasons, we never asked why. We were just happy he was alive. This is the first time I have ever revealed that my father tried to kill himself. It was a deeply personal matter, and I felt we had to protect his reputation. Not even his brothers or sisters were told what had happened. I knew the newspaper columnists would learn from the staff at the Café de Paris that my father was in the hospital. I had to reach them before that happened, so I called the most influential of them all, Walter Winchell, who, in addition to his column, had one of the most listened-to radio programs. If he didn't like you, he could be a ferocious enemy. But from my father's earliest days in New York, he had been kind. We even occasionally had dinner with him. I told Winchell that my father was suffering from exhaustion and had suffered a mild heart attack. I was giving him the story first, I said, an exclusive. Whether he believed me or not, that is what he reported, and that's what was picked up in all the news stories and columns that followed. Looking back as I write this, I wonder how I had the wits to prevent the real story from coming out. But I did. My father's honor and privacy were preserved. My father stayed in the hospital for about a week. While he was hospitalized, his friends in the business and the staff at the Café du Paris made superhuman efforts to keep the club going. In an extraordinary gesture of support, some of the biggest stars of the moment offered to appear at union-scale wages, $125 a week. Singer Dorothy L'Amour, who had skyrocketed to fame in the Road movies with Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, performed for 4 days. Others played for one night, famous comedians like Henny Youngman and Joey Adams. Joey's widow, Cindy Adams, is today a well-known columnist. She and I are good friends, and if people sometimes wonder why we're so close, they should know how long my relationship with Cindy and her late husband goes back. My father also got support from other columnists who always liked his soft-spoken manner. "Seems like everyone is pulling for the game little fellow lying on his back at Mount Sinai Hospital, suffering from exhaustion and a heart attack," wrote Lee Mortimer in the Daily News. Lee had a reputation for being a real SOB, but not where my father was concerned. My father, such a gentleman in such a rough business, was liked and respected by all the Broadway columnists. For all the goodwill, however, the club could not regain any momentum, and barely a month after the Café du Paris opened, it closed. The vultures descended. Creditors appeared out of the woodwork, some demanding to be paid back the money they'd loaned my father, others demanding to be paid for outstanding bills. Everything at the club was up for grabs, the tables, the chairs, the fancy decor. I went down to the disaster scene and asked for only one memento, my father's old typewriter. The days of the penthouses were over. My parents could no longer afford the Navarro Hotel, and I realized I could no longer impose on my friend Marilyn. Living with my parents and Jackie was also out of the question. Not only did circumstances preclude it, I was a grown-up divorced woman. I couldn't and wouldn't retreat into my past. So I had to look for my own apartment, the first I would ever live in alone, and it had to be cheap. When my father was released from the hospital, the solution to several of my parents' problems was for them to move back to Florida, where my father could regain his strength and convalesce. They owned a very nice house on North Bay Road, one of the best locations in Miami Beach. My mother hoped the sunny weather would begin to lift his deep depression. There was no thought of his seeking professional help. My parents were of the generation that would never have considered a psychiatrist. Instead, there was gin rummy. To my mother's everlasting credit, she, the determined non-card player, played gin with my father every day. It helped him keep his mind sharp, and she even became pretty good at it. While she had not always been supportive of her husband in the past, she was a mountain of strength during his emotional breakdown. Slowly, he improved, and the black fog began to dissipate. But he was still in no shape to deal with the reality he was facing in New York, which was rapidly getting worse. "What's wrong?" I asked my mother, hearing the fear in her voice when she called me one morning from Florida. "Taxes," she managed to say. "Your father owes taxes in New York and he can't pay them." And so the next horror began. In his need for money to keep the Café du Paris open, my father had failed to report or pay various business taxes, including the payroll taxes, which he had put back into his floundering business. The IRS was coming after him. The government put a lien on the Florida house. My parents had to sell everything, their car, the house, and the entire contents of the house. The tax agents even took the chandelier off the dining room ceiling. In all the times my mother had worried about reversals in her husband's finances, I don't think she ever thought things would be so dire that they would lose the only home they owned. But despite all her past complaints, she was a very strong woman. When things were the worst, she was the strongest. So she packed up the few things she was allowed to keep and began to look for a small apartment in Miami Beach that they could rent. It was important that the apartment be in walking distance of a supermarket, as neither my mother nor father could drive at that time. During all this, my mother did not blame my father. It was too late for that, and she was concerned about his fragile emotional condition. My sister understood everything, but knew there was nothing she could do but try to help my mother pack. Poor Jackie. She was exposed to all the vicissitudes of her parents' life, with no personal life of her own into which to escape. As for me, I talked twice a day to my mother, assuring her that things would get better, even though I had trouble assuring myself. What a dark period for us all. As all this was going on, I became obsessed with finding the money to pay off as many of my father's debts as I could. I had from early childhood felt responsible for my parents. Hadn't my mother always told me of her problems with my father? I grew up sharing her concerns about his financial state. What was happening may have seemed like a nightmare, but I had dreamed it all before. I didn't know where I was going to find this money. We were not really in touch with my father's family, and remember, they had already refused to loan him money for the Café de Paris. Into my life at that time came a saint, or at least I thought he was. His name was Lou Chestler, a Canadian with a rather dubious reputation as the czar of gambling casinos in the Bahamas. He had been a habitué of the Latin Quarter, both the Florida and New York clubs, and was fond of my father. I had met him several times, but we barely knew each other. When he learned that my father was ill, he telephoned me to ask about him. I didn't mention the suicide attempt, but I did tell him that Dad was in bad shape. However, I said quietly, I was sure we would be all right. Wise man that he was, Mr. Chestler wasn't so sure. He gently asked me if my father had debts. Did he need money? I said he did, and that I was trying to pay them off. I certainly was not thinking of asking him to pay them off. And then came the amazing offer. With no more questions asked, he lent me $20,000, a very substantial amount of money at that time, or any time for that matter. You don't need to pay me back, he said. I was grateful beyond words, and I certainly didn't refuse the loan. My pride was not stronger than my need. But I wasn't a charity case. I wanted to repay it, and I did. Little bit by little bit over the years, until I paid back the whole thing. It still seems incredible that this man, almost a total stranger to me, came to my family's rescue. Perhaps my father had treated him with the respect others had not, or perhaps he was touched by the sense of responsibility I, as a young woman in her 20s, had for my father. Whatever the reason, like something from a corny movie plot, he gave me the money. I never forgot Lou Chestler, and it gives me pleasure to write about him today. My parents left the big house on North Bay Road and moved into the small, inexpensive rental my mother found in Miami Beach. It was off-season, which was a very good thing, because I had now become the sole support of my mother, father, and sister. Everything I had always dreaded might happen had happened. There was no time to cry, and I was too busy to feel sorry for myself. So here is the big question. If my parents had not descended into financial ruin, would I have had the success I have had? Would I, after my divorce, have moved back in with Mom and Dad, perhaps taken a vacation, hung around until I could get another job in television? Was all this, in a strange way, my destiny? By the way, my daughter always says that one of the first things I taught her was that she must always be able to support herself. I guess it's really impossible to know the answer about the whole destiny business, but my feeling is that the answer is yes, very definitely yes. I couldn't find a job in television, which was what I really wanted. I didn't have the luxury of holding out for a job I loved, so I took the closest thing. I went to work in the so-called radio and television department of a public relations firm called Tex McCrary Incorporated. Remember the Tex and Jinx radio and television shows from my days in the publicity department of WNBT? Well, Tex was now a partner in the growing PR firm. I heard that there was an opening, and Tex was receptive to my joining the company. Tex had formerly been a very good newspaper editor, and although I never liked public relations, I learned a great deal from him. He taught me how to put together a story. "Get them with the first line," he would say. "Put your facts in the second line." He was a good teacher to me and to many others. Another of his pupils at the time was a young man named William Sapphire, a junior partner in the firm in charge of the radio and television department. To be accurate, Bill was in charge of me, because except for his secretary, Bill and I were the entire staff of the radio and television department. Bill, who became a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times, had grilled me during my job interview about what was going on in the New York scene and who was what to whom. The job entailed getting positive stories about the products of the firm's clients into newspapers, radio, and television, so knowing the players in the media was essential. And of course, I did, because of my father and the work I had done at WNBT, WPIX, and CBS. When I got the job, I also got my own apartment in a Manhattan building owned by friends of my parents. It was a rear apartment overlooking the backs of several other buildings at 79th Street and then unfashionable 2nd Avenue. It was rather like the apartment I lived in when I was married to Bob Katz, one bedroom, a living room, and a tiny kitchen. Most important, it had a frozen rent. That is, a very low rent that would not be raised every year. It was a godsend. Cousin Shirley helped me fix up the dark little apartment. We bought a $39 yellow rug for the floor, which helped somewhat, but the few pieces of old furniture I'd gotten from my parents' apartment didn't look right. Shirley decided we should paint some of the pieces black and cover the rest with black contact paper, which we did, unaware that what seemed old-fashioned to us was indeed antique. But Shirley still wasn't satisfied. She went out, came back with a pink dish, plunked green grapes on it, and said, "There, that spruces up the whole apartment." I just adored Shirley. My life settled into a routine. I took the bus to and from work every day. There was a supermarket across the street from my apartment, and most nights I would go there, buy a package of sliced bologna and a big roll, head home to make some coffee, and have what I thought was a delicious dinner. I rarely cooked, except for an occasional scrambled egg. I had a very good friend from college, Dorothy Scheckman, who had worked in Paris after graduation and had a wardrobe of magnificent couture clothes from fashion houses like Dior and Balenciaga. She gave me two divine outfits she had grown tired of wearing, from Dior a pale blue-gray fitted wool dress and from Balenciaga a black satin cocktail gown cut low in the back. How I wish I had both dresses today. I've probably never been as chic as I was back then, so if I was alone, it was bologna sandwiches, and if I had a date, Parisian couture. I wore one of those dresses when I turned 30. But neither the dress nor I went out that night. I was supposed to go out with a dashing young socialite stockbroker I'd met by the name of Gianni Uzielli. I washed my hair, did my makeup, put on my lovely dress, and I waited, and I waited, and I, well, you get the picture. Gianni stood me up. I never found out whom he went out with that night, since he never called again, but years later he married a lovely young woman, Anne Ford, granddaughter of Henry Ford. Not an auspicious beginning to my fourth decade, but then neither was my first date with, guess who? None other than Roy M. Cohn. Roy had somehow tracked me down and kept calling to ask me out. I kept turning him down. My extremely negative opinion of Roy Cohn hadn't changed, But finally, perhaps out of curiosity, after all those weeks of watching him on television, I wondered what he was really like, or more probably, needing to take a break from the bologna sandwiches, I said yes. Roy picked me up in his car. People then drove around New York more than they do now. We were going to the 21 Club, the most exclusive restaurant in New York at the time, which was a tonic in itself. But it wasn't 21 that made our first date so memorable. It was how we got there. The traffic on West 52nd Street, 21 is still there, just west of Fifth Avenue, was at a complete standstill. The traffic lights changed from red to green and then to red again, but nothing moved, except for Roy. "Come on," he said suddenly. "We're getting out." And with that, he simply got out of the car, slammed the door, and started walking toward the restaurant. I scrambled after him in disbelief. He had abandoned the car, just like that, in the middle of the street. I remember thinking he had to be the most arrogant, inconsiderate man I'd ever met. But then again, I was an accomplice of sorts, even though I couldn't drive. I was so startled, so caught up in the sheer chutzpah of his bolting from the car, I just got swept along. I have no recollection of how I got back to my apartment after dinner. He probably called some flunky to pick up his car and took me home in a taxi. Anyway, that was my real introduction to Roy Cohn. He called again and then again, but I ducked him as much as possible and saw him very infrequently. When I did see him, I must admit I found him interesting. He seemed to know everything about everything and everyone who was somebody. He was also very funny in a sardonic way. I was never physically attracted to him, nor evidently was he to me, outside of a quick kiss on the cheek he never asked for more. So now and then, when he called, I said yes, and we went out. Nothing close to serious. Besides, I had a new beau who, in his way, was every bit as unlikely as Roy, Philippe of the Waldorf. Claude Philippe had for years been the very well-known head of the catering and banquet department at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, hence the unofficial title. He was in charge of everything from weddings to all special events. I had met him some years before when my father and I went to the Waldorf to check out the hotel as a possible setting for my wedding to Bob Katz. Philippe himself met with us because the bride-to-be, me, was the daughter of Lou Walters of Latin Quarter fame. But for all Philippe's personal attention, my father had chosen the plaza because he thought it was classier. I re-met Philippe at Tex McCrary Incorporated. He had become a client of the agency after his falling out with the Waldorf, caused by a highly public indictment in 1958 for income tax evasion. He had been loudly proclaiming his innocence ever since, and still had a great reputation as a rather flamboyant manager and a connoisseur of food and wine, so I guess his indictment didn't bother me too much, or many others for that matter. Despite the charges against him, Philippe had been snapped up to head the food, drink, and catering business at two other hotels, the Summit and the Americana, and both hotels became clients of Tex McCrary Incorporated. I was assigned to get publicity for their star attraction. Claude Philippe and I had a delightful lunch. He had been born in Paris, was enormously charming and very witty. He knew all about wine, food, restaurants, and was the epitome of sophistication. He started to call. I was thrilled. And so began two of the most romantic years of my life. That he was married to an actress in Paris did not bother me. They were separated. She lived in France. He rarely saw her, he said. There was talk of divorce. I wasn't thinking of marrying again, so his being married somehow didn't bother me. Neither was I bothered by the 18-year difference in our ages. Philippe was elegant, worldly, exciting, and a master of the intimate gesture. Bouquets of yellow roses, love notes in French, a sprig of fresh lavender for my lapel. I was mad for him. I never told my parents I was seeing Philippe. The reaction of Shirley, who kept referring to him as the head waiter, was bad enough. But I didn't care. Philippe and I were both so busy we didn't see each other much during the week. The weekends, however, belonged to us, and they were magical. Philippe owned a big rambling house in Peekskill, New York, and we went there almost every weekend. He was an avid gardener, and my job was to plant new beds of pachysandra. Gardening is not my strong suit. I didn't know pachysandra from poison ivy, but I dutifully spent hours on my hands and knees mucking about in the dirt. And I learned how to plant pachysandra. I wish instead I had learned about wines, but education was not on my agenda with Philippe. The magical parts were not the daytimes, but the evenings. Philippe had an old, quite crotchety but warm-hearted housekeeper who tended the house, along with a humorous young man who helped out on the estate. Philippe would cook us the most delicious meals, complemented always by a bottle of the finest wine, and we would linger at the table, in front of a roaring fire, talking and laughing. Then we would go to bed. Philippe, older and more experienced than the men I had known, was a great lover, tender and passionate. I grew up sexually. We never spent the whole night in the same room, however, because I didn't want the housekeeper to think that we slept together, so I would jump up every morning and tiptoe into the guest room. What can I say? It was a different era. There was never company. Our weekends were just for the two of us. After a year or so, Philippe and I occasionally did talk about getting married, which I may have done had he pursued it. I was in love, probably for the first time. But Philippe dragged his heels about getting a divorce. Instead, he decided it would be a good idea if we rented two apartments next to each other. I didn't think that was a good idea at all. So we meandered along with no real goal, and, as so often happens, the relationship eventually cooled. Philippe finally did divorce his wife, but by then it was over between us. For a couple of years, however, our time together had been extraordinarily romantic and very sophisticated. Like the Cole Porter song, it was just one of those things. And looking back, I have only two regrets. One, my French didn't improve, and two, I never did learn a thing about wine. Throughout my relationship with Philippe, I would, from time to time, still hear from Roy Cohn. Roy didn't take well to rejection, so he was trying a typical ruse. He was attempting to take control of my life by buying his way in. Roy had taken over Lionel Trains in 1959 from a distant relative, the inventor, Joshua Lionel Cowan. Owning the wildly popular electric train sets and their many accessories, like smoke pellets and operating-grade crossings, had been the dream of almost every American child for decades. But sales were declining at the end of the 50s as children turned more to model cars and airplanes. Lionel needed a PR boost, and Roy, because of me, gave the account to Tex McCrary Incorporated. I was still trying, in general, to avoid him, but I was grateful because the account gave me a huge boost in prestige at the firm. It didn't, however, give me a bonus. The agency never offered, and afraid of losing my job, I never asked. The Trains also gave me yet another boost with the Today Show. The host of the popular morning show was still Dave Garraway with the ubiquitous J. Fred Muggs. And guess what Dave Garraway loved above all else? Lionel Trains. At Christmas, he accepted from us an elaborate train setup, and then he played on the air with the new locomotives and cabooses and whatever other Lionel products I kept supplying for free. In those days, before payola became a no-no, he'd then take them all home. Nobody cared, least of all me. The publicity for our client was worth all the free cabooses he wanted. Beyond Dave Garraway's obsession with Lionel Trains, the Today Show was one of the most receptive outlets for all our clients' products. For most of the time I worked at Tex McCrary, Today had to broadcast 3 hours of live programming every day, although it was on the air for only 2 hours in the morning. Videotape technology didn't arrive until 1958, and the first hour in the East had to be repeated for the Midwest and the West. Few guests on the show were willing to wait around for an hour to repeat their interviews or demonstrations or whatever for the third hour, a very different mindset from today, when TV publicity is all important. So today needed every gimmick it could find to fill the time. I supplied many of them. The agency's biggest coup, however, was orchestrated by my boss, Bill Sapphire. The setting was the American Exhibition in Moscow in 1959. Bill's client was Allstate Properties Incorporated, a mass manufacturer of affordable tract homes. And the principal characters were none other than Nikita Khrushchev, the Premier of the Soviet Union, and Richard Nixon, Vice President of the United States. Are you old enough to remember the famous kitchen debate between the number one communist in the world and the number one capitalist? Well, it took place in Moscow because Bill Sapphire somehow managed to maneuver Khrushchev and Nixon, who were touring the exhibition, into Allstate's model all-electric kitchen. There, against the backdrop of our client's ideal kitchen, complete with stove, refrigerator, dishwasher, and washing machine, with flash bulbs flashing and television cameras whirring, Nixon extolled the quality of affordable housing for workers in America. The images ran on the front pages of every newspaper the next day and led the television news. Brilliant. I had nothing to do with Bill's coup in Moscow, but it certainly made it easier for me to get our clients' products into the media and on television. It was not very satisfying work, but I was not in a position to be choosy, since I desperately needed the paycheck for my own expenses, as well as to send whatever I could to my parents. I liked Bill Sapphire enormously, but I felt I was underpaid for all my hard work, so I worked up the nerve to ask him for a raise. He turned me down. Instead of money, he gave me a lecture about supply and demand. Women looking for a job, he said, were in large supply. The demand for such women, however, was slim. Therefore, I should be grateful for what I had. I was. No raise. He understood me in a way I didn't understand myself. My insecurity led me to be a workaholic, to eat lunch at my desk, never to miss a day of work, to make more and still more phone calls on behalf of our clients. I rarely relaxed, which he obviously noticed. That is why, at an office Christmas party, his gift to me was a sheer black shorty nightgown with matching lace panties. I was somewhat embarrassed, but also delighted. Today, when we are so concerned with sexual harassment, such a gift might not be well received. But given my relationship with Bill, I knew that he didn't mean the gift as a come-on. We never dated. Rather, it was a sweet way of noting that underneath my no-nonsense veneer, I was still a female, maybe even a sexy one, and I should enjoy it. Save for my time with Philippe, however, I rarely indulged in enjoyment. I couldn't. I worried constantly about my family and the tax case hanging over my father's head. It took a year, but my father gradually regained his strength and somehow remained the showman he'd always been. While the tax case in New York dragged on in the courts for 2 years, he was hired to produce lavish shows at the fashionable DeVille Hotel in Miami Beach. That led to a 5-year contract at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, where he imported the entire Folies Bergère from Paris beginning on New Year's Eve in 1959. The Folies Bergère was an enormously popular French extravaganza with beautiful showgirls, elaborate costumes, and entertainers who sang, danced, juggled, and in general put on a terrific show. It was just up my father's alley. He knew the managers of the Folies Bergère, and his introduction of it to Las Vegas was a big event. The audiences, accustomed primarily to just one big attraction, loved the whole show. My father now was definitely back on his feet, even if no longer his own boss. But he still owed a great deal of money to the IRS. Before he found work in Las Vegas, my father had occasionally come to New York. When he did, he stayed in my small apartment, sleeping on the other twin bed. I didn't like this. I had never shared a room with either of my parents, and it made me uncomfortable. But there was no extra money for a hotel. The one time my father did stay at a hotel, I got such a scare when I telephoned him and there was no answer. I kept calling, no answer. Terrified that he had attempted suicide again, I ran to the hotel and banged on the door. My father, rubbing sleep from his eyes, opened it. He was fine, just sleeping late by habit. He spent a lot of time trying to work out his tax problems, and I thought he had succeeded. He certainly made it sound as if everything was working out. But then, in the fall of 1960, came another frightening phone call from my mother. I was expecting my father in New York when my mother called from Las Vegas to say he wouldn't be coming. When I asked her why, she said, in that tone of voice I had come to dread, "He can't, or he'll be arrested." Arrested? I sat down hard while she told me that he had missed the latest of the endless series of court dates in New York, and a warrant had been issued for his arrest. He'd told the court that he couldn't afford any more trips to New York, but the judge was evidently unmoved. I couldn't believe it. My father a criminal? Unable to return to the city he loved and to which he had contributed so much joy. I felt sick. I didn't know what to do. I realized I was shivering and drew a hot bath. I was in the tub, crying, when the phone rang. It was Roy Cohn. "What's the matter?" he asked. Lord knows why, but I was so upset I told him what my mother had said. "Get dressed and come and meet me and we'll talk about it," he said. I did. For years, my friends have wondered why I became a loyal friend of Roy's. I remember Walter Cronkite once asking if he could put a very personal question to me. What was the question? How could you possibly have had Roy Cohn for a friend? I understood, and still understand, how people ask such a question. Here is the answer I have never given before. When I got out of the bath and dressed, I met with Roy and told him exactly what was happening. A week after that meeting, the charges against my father were dropped. Did Roy perhaps pay the back taxes himself? I doubt it. He had strong connections and friendships with most of the major judges in New York. Roy's father, Albert Cohn, had himself been a judge. Over the years, for one reason or another, Roy had done a lot of favors for various judges and politicians. So a much more likely scenario is that he asked for a favor in return, and got it. I don't know exactly how he did it. I asked, but Roy would never tell me. All I know is that because of Roy, the arrest warrant against my father was dropped and the court case was settled. My father's reputation was restored. He was able to come back to New York. Forget the ethics of the matter. We are talking about my father. After what he did, Roy had my gratitude and loyalty from then on. Television 102 and a strange marriage proposal. Do you believe in fate, luck, timing, all of the above? Well, I must, because today I might well be the president of an important headhunting employment agency, recruiting executive secretaries and prospective CEOs. I think I might have been really good at that job, but fate, luck, or timing intervened. Here's how it happened. By 1961, I had more or less had it at Tex McCrary. I was tired of trying to sell clients who were not suitable for television. My pal and boss, Bill Sapphire, had left the agency to open his own PR firm. He would later fold that company to go to work as a speechwriter for then-President Richard Nixon. There still seemed to be nothing for me in television, so I took myself to a top employment agency, deciding it was about time to start a new career. Instead of sending me out to other companies, they offered me a job right there to go to work for them, screening and hiring secretaries. They gave me a couple of days to decide, and I was on the verge of saying yes. Just think of what a good interviewer I would have made, probing prospective secretaries. Instead, while I was trying to make up my mind, I got an offer from Redbook. The magazine had heard about my work at Tex McCrary Incorporated and was offering me more money to publicize their articles. So I said okay, thinking I'm back in the public relations trap again, but at least it's a trap I know. So, off to Redbook, where I was bored and somewhat unhappy, but it didn't matter. Working was not a choice for me, but a necessity, and this was the best job I could get. I often think of all the men, they were mostly men at the time, who had to work at jobs they really hated until they got to the next step, the next promotion. Unlike some of my women friends who had jobs but could quit or get married if things got tedious, the men and I had to work. It's all changed now, of course, and many women face the same need to earn an income. But back then, the burden fell mostly to men, whether or not they enjoyed what they were doing. I didn't much enjoy what I was doing at Redbook, but it wasn't torture. Then, one absolutely wonderful day, I got a call from the new producer of the Today Show, Fred Freed, saying he needed a writer. It wouldn't be a long-term job, he told me. It was for a limited time on a limited segment, but if I wanted to try it, it was mine. Did I want to try it? Is the Pope Catholic? I realized I was giving up a steady job for something that was short-term, but I loved working in television. The creativity, the interesting people, the whole atmosphere. And unlike in PR, I wasn't constantly selling. Moreover, I felt if I worked hard and did well, I just might be offered a permanent position on the staff. I should remind you that I had known Fred Freed back in my CBS days. He was one of the producers on the morning show I wrote for. Fred would go on to be one of the great creators of television documentaries. But then he had been brought in to revitalize the Today Show, which was getting slightly draggy. Another footnote about Fred, he was also the father of a young producer I would later work with on ABC's News Magazine 2020. Her name is Casey Freed Jennings. She is also the widow of Peter Jennings. When I worked for her father, I remember Casey as an adorable little girl. Now she is a strong and talented woman. Anyway, back to 1961. In order to get new advertisers on Today, the NBC brass decided to actually sell a piece of the program to a single sponsor. Rather than having a string of commercials from different companies, they wanted to be able to say, "The next half hour is brought to you by so-and-so." The so-and-so they got was S&H Green Stamps, which was owned by Sperry & Hutchinson, a successful consumer marketing rewards business. S&H, in turn, wanted to attract a female audience to their product. So they hired a beautiful ex-model, socialite, and former actress who had won the hearts of many of her leading men, including, it was said, Clark Gable. Her name was Anita Colby, and she was so lovely that her nickname was The Face. A perfect match for S&H, she had class and looks and was of a certain age. Something that was much admired in those days before television wanted everyone to be young, young, young. My job was to be the producer-writer on the 5 times a week, 5-minute segments with Anita. I was to create material revolving around fashion, trends, beauty tips, how-to advice on such crucial matters as properly tying a scarf, entertaining at home, preparing for the holidays, and so on. Occasionally, I would throw in a quickie interview, write some funny patter, and we would fill up the 5 minutes quite easily. Anita was very much a lady, and a nice one, too, but she was limited as a performer. She had done little television, and all this was extremely difficult for her. Her life was dinner parties and supper clubs. We could never do a cooking or food feature, for example, because Anita could barely find her way into her own kitchen. She once told me that when she had to cook bacon, she put the strips into hot butter. Yuck! Even I, a lousy cook, knew better than that. The schedule was grueling. 5 mornings a week, I showed up at the studio at 4:30 a.m., having taken a taxi, not always easy to find at that hour, from my apartment on 79th Street. Anita would arrive an hour later to be made up and get her hair done, which, in those pre-blow-dryer days, required sitting under a hot beauty parlor hood for an hour. The early hours were a big problem for Anita. The poor woman got so exhausted that one day, just after finishing her 5-minute segment, she fainted. We weren't sure that she would return the next morning, but she did. Not only that, the segment was renewed after the first 3 months, as was my contract. I was thrilled. I was making only a few $100s a week, but I was back in the business I loved. I enjoyed writing the scripts and scouting for new ideas that Anita could talk about. Once Anita left the studio, I spent the rest of the day planning the fashions, writing more scripts, booking the guests, the sort of thing I had been doing for years. This was mother's milk for me. And then it was over. After the second 3 months of our segment, SNH Green Stamps decided that the face wasn't exactly the face collectors of SNH Green Stamps could relate to. So, Anita got axed. I think she was relieved that she could go back to her life of dining at the Stork Club and dancing at El Morocco. As I said, she was a very nice lady, and we stayed in touch for quite a while, although I never let her make bacon for me. Anita may have been fine with being fired, but I was distraught. I thought the axe was going to fall on me, too. No Clark Gable was going to whisk me away to El Morocco. For me, it would be back to the employment agency. But just before the axe fell, lightning struck, and my life changed, never to be the same again. There were 8 writers on the Today Show then who also produced the interviews and features. Of the 8, only one was a woman. There were never 2. It wasn't until that woman left the program voluntarily or died that she would be replaced. But to my very good fortune, here comes the luck, the one female writer who was there chose that moment to decide to get married. And there I was, ready, willing, and on the spot. Fred Fried hired me full-time. I was given a small office in the RCA building in Rockefeller Plaza, which I shared with one of the 7 male writers, a delightful Englishman named John Lord. We had a great relationship, as indeed I had with all the other writers. They couldn't have been more helpful, though our assignments were very different. The female writer's job at that time was limited to writing specifically for whoever was the so-called Today Girl. How Neanderthal it seems now to look back to the era of the Today Girls, who were only assigned the features geared for women and, of course, the weather. By the time I joined the staff, there had been at least 9 of them. On air, they could ad-lib with the other cast members and look pretty, but that was it. I called them tea pourers, though it was through no fault of their own. Some were accomplished actresses like Betsy Palmer and Estelle Parsons. Others were fine singers like Florence Henderson and Helen O'Connell, or beauty pageant winners like Leanne Merriweather, a former Miss America, and Robin Bain, a former Miss Rheingold. The Miss Rheingold competition was a staple in New York for 22 years, an ingenious interactive promotion for Rheingold beer, which plastered posters of the 6 gorgeous finalists all over subways, buses, and stores, and invited the public to vote for their favorite. And vote they did, making the Miss Rheingold race second only in number of votes cast to that for U.S. president. That the Today Girl's major requirement on the Today Show was to look wide awake and pretty at 7 a.m. was not surprising. In that "don't worry your pretty little head" era, the popular culture on television mirrored the sweet and subservient image of the good wife. It did not include women who were doing anything with their brains. I Love Lucy had wound down its spectacular run, and one of the most popular entertainment shows at the time was Leave It to Beaver, the sugary portrait of a perfect, happy suburban family doted on by a perfect, happy wife and mother. The women's movement had yet to be born. John F. Kennedy was president in 1961, and more women aspired to wear Jackie Kennedy's pillbox hats and sleeveless linen sheaths than to enroll at MIT. Still, change was in the air at the Today Show. Once again, the timing was on my side. The catalyst was Dave Garraway. He has been somewhat forgotten, but in those days, he was a huge star. For 9 years, he had been the urbane and witty host of the Today Show, and he still held all the reins. Very little happened that he didn't control or approve. He had to sign off on me when Fred Fried decided to hire me. But first, so did his ferocious secretary. Only after I got her approval was I ushered in to see Garraway. That first meeting was a little odd. While we talked, he kept sipping something out of a bottle in his desk. He vaguely remembered me as the person who used to supply him with Lionel trains, and he was slightly flirtatious. He asked me a few questions, seemed mildly interested in the answers, And that was that. After I was hired, I had little actual contact with him. Garraway's talent was an ability to appear laid back and relaxed. He seemed to be talking directly to the viewer. He always ended the program, holding his hand up and saying, "Peace," nice and calm. He knew a lot about a lot of things, and the network backed him for years. But by 1961, he was becoming increasingly demanding and his behavior more eccentric and erratic, which may have been the result of whatever was in that bottle he referred to as the doctor. Garraway said the doctor gave him energy. No one ever asked him just what was in the concoction, but whatever it was, it no longer seemed to improve his performance or disposition. He had started to bawl out writers for simply writing a sentence he didn't like. Mercifully, because I was writing for the Today Girl and not for him, I wasn't on his radar. Sometimes he would upend the carefully planned show and move all the guests from the second hour into the first, throwing off everything. The teleprompters, props, the lighting. Poor Fred Freed. No wonder he was beginning to count the days until he could leave the show. Garraway's personal life had also just taken a terrible blow. His wife Pam, mother of his 3-year-old son, had committed suicide in April 1961, just before I arrived at the show. That would have devastated the strongest of men, and Dave was already somewhat unstable. 3 years before, he had collapsed into the arms of the Today Girl just before they went on the air. The medical diagnosis had been physical exhaustion, and he returned to the air a month later. But there was continuing concern that he was taking downers to sleep and uppers to cope with the show's cruel hours. It all came to a head during his contract renewal negotiations with NBC that same spring of 61. Dave lay down on the floor of his office just before airtime and refused to get up unless NBC honored his demands. By then, the powers that be were so worried about his behavior that they wouldn't humor him. Just as NBC had retired J. Fred Mugg some years before, the chimp became too aggressive, so they decided to retire Dave Garraway. His last show was on June 16, 1961. Garraway would go on to produce or appear on several other television shows over the years, but he never regained the prominence he had on Today. He would remarry. In January 1982, he made a nostalgic appearance on the Today Show for its 30th anniversary broadcast. He seemed his old, upbeat self, but 6 months later, he shot himself in the head. Garraway's stepson, Michael, ascribed his suicide to post-operative complications from open-heart surgery. What a sad end for the man who had been the brilliant father of morning television. Garraway's departure from the helm of the Today Show set in motion a whole sequence of events. One change affected the program more than it did the audience, which didn't even know the difference. The Today Show had been under the auspices of the entertainment division, but the news-oriented president of NBC, Robert Kintner, decided to transfer the program from entertainment to the news department and replace Dave Garraway with a more sober-sided journalist. Male, of course. Veteran correspondent John Chancellor became the new morning host, and to my great delight and surprise, he brought in Shad Northshield as Today's new producer. Fred Freed had recently left to start his new career as a producer of documentaries, but I wasn't affected. I had worked with Shad at CBS, and I liked him enormously. He was a big bear of a man with a great sense of humor, which is just what we all needed after Dave Garraway's latter-day reign of terror. All should have been well, but it wasn't. John Chancellor was attractive, bright, articulate, and completely wrong for the show. He was a serious journalist and stood in sharp contrast to Garraway. Viewers were used to watching him playing with trains and making jokes about the girls in bathing suits. In a million years, John Chancellor would never have tolerated working with a chimpanzee.